My name is Debbie Buchwald. I'm the director of the America-Israel Chamber of Commerce. I'm delighted to see so many of you here tonight. I want to thank Pepper Hamilton for hosting this evening's program. Pepper has been a corporate member of the chamber nearly since its inception, and Ben Strauss is a past president of AICC and a member of our executive board. He continues to devote a lot of time and effort and guidance to the chamber. I'm going to turn the program over to him.
Thank you. Just realized the problem with having to speak after a cocktail event that you kind of lose your voice, so bear with me here. First, I'd like to thank Debbie for arranging this event and also the Middle East Forum for co-sponsoring the event. I'd like to also recognize Howard Jaffe. Where's Howard? All the way in the back, past president of the chamber. David Gitlin, who is the current president, was supposed to introduce me, and then there are a few notes that he was supposed to say. So, yeah, I will pretend that I'm David Gitlin. There are a few things I have to say, and I'm going to read. So you have to excuse me for doing that this way. Anyway, it says there warm words of welcome. So here we go. Sort of kidding aside, it's a great pleasure to see everyone here at Pepper Hamilton. As Debbie mentioned, we have been members of the chamber for over 15 years and been very active in many respects. I've seen chamber members come and go, but it's always great to see an event by the chamber. And this event is especially important given the events, the rapid events in Israel. We started 2006 with news that economy is great, budget surplus, Moody rating high, and everything looked great on the economic side. And then, of course, the war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and things turn around. And what we decided as chamber leadership is that we need to get a little bit education on what's going on the economic side in Israel with all this turmoil, try and sort it out. And the best person to do that is Ron Dermer. Ron is, and let me make sure I get your title right, you're the economic minister to North America out of the embassy in Washington. But Ron is also a local guy. He graduated from Wharton. He then went off to Oxford. He has a political family, which I understand his dad was a former mayor of Miami Beach. His brother is the mayor of Miami Beach. Democrat, unfortunately, but you know, no one is perfect. And Ron has served as a consultant to Benjamin Netanyahu and Natan Sharansky. So he certainly is very well tuned to what's going on in Israel. And I invite Ron.
Thank you very much. I saw outside that they had mints all set out. And then I see that they put the comfortable chairs in the back, and I'm thinking to myself, do I have bad breath? Is that sort of the combination of the two of them? But I don't blame anyone for thinking in the back. The most important thing in a speech is that you be comfortable. The more comfortable you are, the better I'm going to sound. So let me first say what I say every time I speak publicly anywhere. Can you hear me in the back of the room?
Yes.
I'm from Miami Beach. You know, you always have to start a speech that way. Let me say thank you to the chamber. I've had the opportunity I've been in Washington in my post for a year and a half. I have had the opportunity to speak at a few chambers around the country, and I can say, and I hope I won't offend chambers elsewhere, that this is certainly one of the best in the quality of events that they host. Also, the people who you invite, obviously, is very important. I want to thank Debbie and the chamber for hosting it, and also the Middle East Forum, led by Daniel Pipes. I'm a diplomat, so I can't, I'm not allowed to shill for people, but let me just say about Daniel Pipes, that there are a few people who are doing more good in the struggle against the fanaticism that not only Israel faces, but the whole world faces, than Daniel Pipes. And I would encourage you, And as I just said, whatever he's doing, I know that it's more important than him sitting in this room today, because he is a whirling dervish of productivity when it comes to confronting whatever you want to call them, Islamic, fascist, genocidal maniacs, you take your pick. He is confronting them all the time, and it is so important that his very proud and clear voice gets heard and gets amplified. I want to tell you about what's going on in Israel's economy mostly, and then I'm sure that maybe you'll have some questions that I'll get Tom to answer. I was here a year ago, and I'm pretty sure it was in the fall, because I remember it being cold also. In fact, every time I come in, I seem to bring in a cold front with me. Let's rewind, and let's go back to a year ago. And I see some of the faces here, in fact, quite a few, were at my speech last year, and I want to thank you for that, because, you know, it's a good thing to have a good speech. It's another to get a repeat customer. That's always welcome. But let's assume that I gave the speech that I gave last year about the state of Israel's economy. And then last year, on October 24th, 2005, I gave you my predictions for the next year in Israel. And here would be my predictions of what would happen. A few days from now, I would have said then, let's just pretend it's October 24th, 2005. A few days from now, a unabashed socialist will be elected leader of the second largest party in Israel. A few weeks after that, the sitting prime minister of Israel would leave his Likud party, sending the whole political system into disarray. A few weeks after that, that sitting prime minister would be felled by a stroke that incapacitates him. 2 weeks after that, Hamas would win the Palestinian elections. A few weeks after that, Israel would have elections, and the results of the elections would be a prescription for instability. The leading party would get less than 30 seats, there would be a patchwork coalition, and it would be led by a prime minister that, while he has been in the political system for quite some time, at least on the security front, had fairly limited experience. And then, a couple months after that, a war would start between Israel, not start, because starts, you know, I don't want to speak in the passive. Hezbollah would launch a war against Israel. And that war would go on for a month, and 4,000 missiles will rain down in Israel. It's October 24th, 2005. And that's the prediction I'm going to give you. And right before I leave, I tell all of you, invest in Israel. Put your money in Israel. Because if you don't put your money in Israel, you're going to lose a lot of money. But you didn't have to imagine it. That's exactly what has transpired over Israel, in Israel, over the last year. But despite all the trials and tribulations, Israel's economy emerges strong, not just strong, very strong, and roaring ahead. So the question that I want to answer today is why? How could it be that you had all these exogenous shocks into the system? How could it be that Israel's economy could be in the situation that it is? How can Israel defy the laws of economic gravity? I mean, political stability is important, right? Many people here may be in hedge funds, invest in companies, and certainly political stability tends to be a factor. What about geopolitical risk? Shouldn't that have been a factor? And yet there was virtually no effect whatsoever. Why? Well, let's go then to the, we'll fast forward from October 24th, 2005, and we'll go to July 12th, 2006. That was that beautiful morning when Hezbollah terrorists crossed an international border, killed soldiers, kidnapped soldiers, launched missiles on Israeli towns and villages in the north of the country, and started a war that went on for a few weeks. What was the state of the Israeli economy on July 12th, the morning of the July 12th? Israel was growing faster than any country in the Western world. We were growing by over 6%, 6.2%. That was after 2 years in 2001 and 2002 of negative growth, followed by a turnabout in 2003. 2004, Israel grew by over 4%, 2005 over 5%, and in the first half of 2006, Israel grew by 6%. Unemployment in Israel on the eve of the war was 8.8%. That's high by American standards. It's not so high by European standards. But unemployment had gone down over the past 2 or 3 years from 11% to 8.8%. And it went down at a time when a lot of people were entering the labor force. You know, all else equal, when people enter the labor force searching for jobs, the unemployment rate goes up. But here you had a massive influx of people relative to Israel's size entering the labor force, and the unemployment rate went down. Inflation was completely under control. The stock market had gone up roughly between 150 and 200% over the previous 2.5 years. The GDP, the debt-to-GDP ratio, I should say, which is probably the single most important ratio that credit analysts who look at Israel look at. That's how much debt you have and what's your GDP. Now, why is that important? For the same reason it's important for an individual to go to a bank. What's a bank looking at? They're looking at your wealth and your income, because those tell you your ability to pay your debt in the future. And when that number gets too high, when you cannot carry this debt, that's when ratings agencies will downgrade your debt. Well, Israel's credit rating in 2003, debt to GDP ratio, was 106%. Take all our economic growth for the year, our entire GDP, for the year, it would have to go back to paying off the national debt. That's very high. Very, very high. On July 12, 2006, that number was under 95%. It was around 93% and was heading towards 89% by the end of the year. We had a budget, now everyone check their ears, a budget surplus in Israel. Never thought that you'd see or hear that in the same sentence. A budget surplus in Israel on July 12th, and we were expected to come in at the end of the year with a surplus. We have a current accounts surplus in Israel. I can list all these statistics, but the bottom line was best said by one international analyst, I think it was for Deutsche Bank, who said that Israel's economic situation is almost perfect. That's how he described it. And then you had the war. So how could it be that this war would happen and would have little effect? The first thing that should happen for the war, right, would be the shekel. We'd have a serious problem with the currency. And those of you who were following the war and what was happening immediately to the Israeli economy, I was talking to about it someone before, they saw the V. All of a sudden, within hours, Israel's currency had lost about 8%, 5, 6%, I don't remember the exact number, of its value. And then within days, it started to return. At the end of the war, the shekel was stronger than it was at the beginning of the war. Markets, the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, same thing. Lost about 8% in the first few hours. By the end of the war, the stock market was stronger than it was before. So again, the question is why? How could this happen? Well, the first suspect is the war itself. The war itself was very limited. It was about 35 days. It was difficult. You had 4,000 missiles landing in Israel, and you had a million Israelis who were displaced, 15% of the country. In American terms, that would be about 45 million Americans who would be displaced by a war. But it was relatively limited, and obviously had the war gone on for a very long time, the impact of the war would have been great. And the war really had two effects, direct effects on Israel's economy. The first is in manufacturing in the north. Here's a funny thing about Israelis. It's very bizarre. When missiles are landing at their workplace, they don't actually go to work. Imagine that. Israelis, when the missiles were landing in their places of business, they went south. They stayed with family and friends. By the way, we took in our refugees. We had a million refugees. We just took them in. We didn't put them in front of the world to go be used in a pawn in some sort of propaganda struggle like, unfortunately, our enemies do time after time after time. It repeats itself. So you had manufacturing facilities who were operating at a fraction of capacity. Some of them were not operating at all. That affected the economy. There's no question about that. But when the war ended 35 days later, those plants were back at full capacity. In fact, they were back at 150% capacity. And some of them during the war made all sorts of adjustments, especially in high-tech where they could do their business from home. And I'm sure that people in here have personal stories of people who worked in different plants or businesses in the northern part of the country that were doing their business from different areas. The second impact of the war is the impact of tourism. Now, if I told you that I was going to give you two free tickets to Bosnia for you and your wife, you can spend a week in beautiful Bosnia. you probably wouldn't be so thrilled by the prospect. But I bet you...
Is that a lot?
I bet you that the situation in Bosnia is not bad at all. But you know what? It takes years and years and years to recover from that sense that you have of the war that you can go and visit Israel. It takes a long time to recover from that. It's today that you're talking about 10, 12 years later where people will be reticent to go. Israel during 2000 and 2001, its tourist economy collapsed. It lost two-thirds of its tourist economy. And it was just starting to come back. It lost about two-thirds, and then it was back to about 70 to 80% of where it was in 2000. And now all of a sudden it will take another hit. It will take a hit in general because it will take many months to get over. And in fact, this war was probably of all the issues, and every time I should say that Israel was on the news, I have never seen a time when Israel was more of the focus of the news than it was this time. For 30 days, 2.5 hours out of three hours primetime television, I'm sure like me, you were switching, you know, CNN and MSNBC, you're saying, who's worse for us? You know, just start making the game, go to Fox, go to this. But I got to the point where I was sick of watching news about Israel. So I can imagine what the average person doing it. And to have 2.5 hours out of 3 hours on prime time with missiles landing is not good for business. And it's going to affect the economy as a whole, the tourist economy as a whole, and will also specifically affect the North. But I have a question. I'm going to pick on you. Tell me what percentage of Israel's GDP is tourism.
One-third.
Anyone? Wait, I got to get hands. We can't just blur it out.
7.5%.
7.5%. One more. 75%. Tourism represents 1.7% of Israel's economy. 1.7%. You know, the days of the JNF boxes are over. You're looking at me, you're shocked. It can't be right. You're going to run and you're going to Google it. I know you're going to Google it, but you're going to find out that I'm right. It's 1.7%. In 2000, it was 2.7% before it collapsed. But when it collapsed, you lost about two-thirds. It was under 1% of the economy. And then as the economy grew, tourism grew by more than the economy, but it has not gone back to where it was before. It's less than 2%. And let's say that the numbers are wrong, that they can figure out tourism some other way. Maybe it's double that. 4%, 5%, 6%. It's a much smaller share than what people think. And that's why the impact of tourism and the decline of tourism that will inevitably come will be much less than people think. Much less than people think. It will take time. And unfortunately, today, I was just in Israel 2.5 weeks ago, and those of you who have been there in the recent past will probably find if you go to the north that it's going to be difficult for you to find a place. Because a lot of Israelis who would otherwise go to Cyprus and to Greece and to Turkey have decided, for patriotic reasons, I suppose, to spend their money in northern Israel. So even in terms of the dislocation of the northern tourist economy, you're seeing Israelis from all over the country go and to try to support it. I'm not saying it's not difficult. I'm not saying it's not a blow. But you have to look at the economy as a whole. You know, I know that there are a lot of organizations that are working to help those who were harmed by the war. I applaud all those efforts. I think it's important because I will tell you that just because America's economy was strong last year didn't necessarily help the people in New Orleans. You know, you got Katrina in New Orleans. You got people with real needs. The government won't fully be able to address it. You've got to help. But that's not to say that the American economic juggernaut is going to collapse. And that's the situation that you have in Israel. A small share of the economy of tourism was definitely hurt. But the impact is limited. Now, you could argue that it's a limited war, it wasn't so bad, and that's why the economy continues. But the reason why that would be wrong is because it doesn't account for the morning of July 12th. It doesn't account for why the economy was so good to begin with and why the economy is so good after. It just means that this was not as big a blow as we thought it was. But why was Israel's economy growing at 6%? And why are the numbers after the war such that Israel's economy may grow 4.6, 4.7, 4.8%? Numbers that, by the way, most governments in the industrialized world would take tomorrow without any problem. So why? I would say that there are three major reasons why. And the first reason is Israel's fiscal policy. Now, I understand that my former boss, perhaps future boss, Benjamin Netanyahu, was in this town a few weeks ago. Well, I was once at a meeting with Netanyahu, with a certain politician who I, world leader I will not name. And he said to this leader that, you know, what Thatcher did in England was far more impressive than what Reagan did in America. And they asked him why. And he said, because America was built right to begin with. Thatcher had to take a half-socialist, half-feudal country and to put major reforms. Well, by that account, what Netanyahu did for Israel is much more impressive than what Thatcher did. Because Netanyahu was taking what at its core was a socialist country with a socialist mentality and not just putting it on the rails, but building the rails. And Israel's fiscal policy has seen a dramatic turnaround in the last year. Some of you were here last time when I spoke, and I focused a lot of my remarks specifically on that, so I'm not really going to go into detail. But let me just quickly say some of the things that Netanyahu did in the very brief time that he was in office. And he did this, by the way, with the full backing of the prime minister. You know, they didn't always see, it's not always a love fest in Israeli politics. You know, we have our differences too, and they didn't always see eye to eye, but Sharon gave Netanyahu the backing that he needed to save the economy with the right fiscal policy, and he did it. And he did it by drastically cutting spending, by drastically cutting taxes. In America, they increased spending and cut taxes, which created a lot of problems. In Israel, they did reverse tax and spend. Cut spending, cut taxes. Cut spending, cut taxes. Cut personal taxes from 64 to 49%. And now it's down to, it's going down to 44% on autopilot. Cut corporate taxes from 36 to 25%. Cut VAT tax, which, as I've said before, is like the sales tax on steroids. You know, and it only goes up 18%. The first time I came to Israel, 18%. You know, 18%. You know, I was shocked. In Israel, it was going up and up and up and up to 18. Then he cut it to 17 to 16.5. Now it's 15.5. High, should go further, but it's moving in the right direction. In addition to that, you saw very accelerated privatization. Israel privatized El Al, it privatized Bezeq, the national phone company. Maybe you get better service on the plane now that El Al is privatized. That's also a good reason to go to Israel. Now, I understand, by the way, that the chamber is going to be hosting a trip. Are you flying El Al? You're flying El Al. So you see, now the benefit of going on this trip, is to actually get good service on El Al because now it's a private company. You know, it's amazing what the ability to hire and fire can do towards to service. You had El Al, Bezeq, you had a national shipping company, Zim Shipping, and you had two major banks, Israel Discount Bank and Bank Leumi, that the controlling interests were sold off. That's all happened in the last 2 years, 2.5 years. In addition to that, you had massive investment in infrastructure. Usually what happens when you have fiscal reform, first thing that gets cut is any long-term plan. That's usually what happens because that's the difficult decisions. You know, difficult decisions are the short-term stuff that you always have to give out politically. Netanyahu didn't take that route. He allowed the money to go to infrastructure to build Israel's roads and rails and focused on a lot of welfare cuts that were very difficult, very deep, but I believe were the right things in order to move the economy in a different direction. The last thing that he did was major structural reform. I spoke a little bit about this last time, but Israel reformed the government pension system. We've reformed it in a way that every country will eventually have to do it, and that is we have increased the retirement age from women to 60 to 64, from men to 65 to 67. They made modest changes in contributions, modest changes in benefits, and voila, a fiscally insolvent system is now fiscally solvent. I remember reading that many years ago that in 1933 when they passed the Social Security Act, the life expectancy was 63 years old. So no one really believed that people would be collecting Social Security. And now people work longer, they live longer, and I think an adjustment is something that every country will have to do. It should be done over time. You can't tell somebody who's 59 today that they need to work another 6 years. But you might be able to tell somebody who's 55 that they need to work one more year than they otherwise would, and 50, two more years, and 45, three more years. And those changes, if you look at the actuarial tables and the government deficits in the future, they can make big changes. Very few political leaders have the courage to address it. I personally believe that if an American politician would run on it and would be a straight talker about it, that he'd be able to rally the country around it because people understand that the situation has changed. But unfortunately, no one has shown that will. Netanyahu showed that will. and was able to push through the reform. The second thing was port reform. Israel, you know, used to have more strike days than Italy, believe it or not. But those of you, anyone read of a strike at the ports for the last 2 years? No. It's amazing what a country can do when it can get its goods in and out of the country. And that's what happened by creating competing government companies. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but it's essentially a privatization that will take some time. I don't want to get into the details. And the third was capital market reform, which was the biggest reform. The banks in Israel controlled both manufactured and distributed the financial assets to the public. That could create some conflicts of interest. It hurt returns for the public, hurt investment in the country. That has changed. The banks have been forced, essentially, to sell off those assets, and the banking duopoly that has long dominated Israel is now not immediately coming to an end, but is on its way to an end. There are more financial players. Most of the insurance companies are the ones that came in there, but it's better to have six players than to have two players, and hopefully six players will lead to more players in the future. You had a dramatic reversal of fiscal policy over 2.5 years, and guess what? Netanyahu resigned from the government. The next day, the stock exchange went down 7%, almost what it did in the time of the war. In fact, he resigned, I think, at 4 p.m., and the markets closed at 5, and in 1 hour it went down 7%. But it came back. It came back because the markets understood that his successors were committed to the same policies. They may politically sound different, but they were acting the same. They were continuing to implement his policies. And you had a successor in Ehud Olmert, and now you have a new successor in Avram Herson, who is now my boss, and he is committed to the same policies. And when people saw that commitment, that the ship was being steered in the same direction, that was something that people said is going to have a long-term effect. That's the first reason, very sound fiscal policy, and Netanyahu is the one who I believe deserves most of the credit for it. The second thing, the second reason is monetary policy. Somebody, is Ben Bernanke, is he from here, from Philadelphia? He's not, okay, so I won't offend anybody when I say that...
No, the
vice chairman's from Philadelphia. Well, let me just say this. Now that Alan Greenspan is retired, I can confidently say that Israel has the finest central banker in the world. Stanley Fisher is the finest central banker in the world. Now, some people think that it's not really important to have such a good central banker. I mean, after all, what does a central bank governor do? They end up in a meeting somewhere in a back room. They get into their little black box, and out comes a number. And so maybe it's the same thing as those chimps that used to throw darts at the stock market. They can do just as well as the money managers, right? What difference does it make? What's important is the number that comes out. Is it going to be up 0.25%, down 0.25%, up 0.5%, down 0.5%, and the effect that it's going to have on the real economy? That's wrong. And it's wrong because the most important asset that a central banker has is credibility, is his prestige. What a central banker who the public markets have confidence in, what he can do with 0.25%, somebody else, it will take them 0.5 point or a full point. And the effect on the real economy can be very dramatic. It's the same thing, by the way, in statecraft. If you have a prime minister that the other side thinks is willing to take very forceful action, he can achieve the same result with relatively less action. The same thing with a central banker. The prestige, the reputation of a central banker is critical. It is not some sort of a technocrat. He must give confidence to the markets. And because Stanley Fisher was Zionist enough to give up a tremendous job that he had here and come to Israel, become a citizen, deal with a lot of aggravation. Believe me, I'm American who came to Israel. I can't even get to a fraction of the aggravation that he must have had to deal with. But he's tremendously important for Israel. During the war, and all the events that I told you about from last October 24th, Stanley Fisher was at the helm of the central bank, which is important, very important, because these effects can, perceptions can affect the outcome, and all of a sudden Stanley Fisher's there, people have confidence. During the war, Stanley Fisher raised the interest rate. He was criticized in Israel for raising the interest rate. And if you look at how Greenspan responded to various different shocks, he always lowered rates. In 1987, he lowered interest rates after the crash. In 1998, when you had a currency crisis, he lowered rates. In 2001, he lowered rates. And the reason why they lowered rates is because, fortunately, he had learned the lesson of the Great Depression. And the lesson of the Great Depression, contrary to what many people believe, is that at a time when they needed liquidity in the market, the banking system pulled the rug out. and became very, very tight-fisted with money. What would have been a recession, maybe it would have been a difficult recession, maybe it would have lasted a year and a half, became a deep, deep depression because of the failure to take the right action. So since that time, every time there's been a crisis, America has reduced rates. So why did Israel raise rates, and why was it the right decision? Well, I believe that he made the right decision. I mean, and not only because almost every decision he's going to make, I think, is going to be the right one, but I believe he made the right decision because Israel is not America. We are not a parking lot of money. People are not going to leave America in droves when the rates change. Israel is a different story entirely. Israel, its international investors are very, very sensitive to what happens, and having that extra percentage sent the message that we're going to keep things under control. That may affect growth a little bit here and there, but the financial system is going to remain safe. And not only that, what's far more important is that he sent a message to Israelis not to take their money out. Much more important, because still Israel, as, and I know there are people who deal with Israel and investing in Israeli companies here, but Israel, relative to other industrialized countries, has a very small fraction of its assets invested abroad. It used to be a few years ago only about 3%. It has since gone up. It doubles to maybe 6%. I believe it will double at least in the next few years, and that's why I think there's tremendous opportunities for Israelis who will seek ways to put their capital abroad. But he had to make sure that this huge money in Israel didn't head for the exits. And he did that. And that's why the clear monetary policy and the effective leadership of Fisher, complemented with Netanyahu's fiscal policy that has been kept up by his successors, were very important. But I have to tell you that those two things are very important, but at the end of the day, they're rudders or steering wheels on the ship. And I don't want to denigrate the importance of a rudder. You know, you move a rudder in the right direction, you're going to end up miles off course, or you may go around even in circles. Right? So rudders are important. And with Netanyahu's rudder and with Fisher at the helm, it was moving forward. But it was not the engine of Israeli growth. That is not the engine of Israeli growth. The engine of Israel's growth is its people. That's the engine of growth. And everybody hears those statistics, and I might have mentioned it last time I'm here, but people don't pay any attention to what that actually means. It's like a nice statistic on a page. When you hear that Israel has more scientists per capita than any country in the world, more engineers per capita than any country in the world, highest educated workforce in the world, more patents registered in Israel than Russia, China, and India combined, more scientific publications per capita. Just last week, I saw an article in Israel that said biotech patents, they've had more from Hebrew University than either Yale or Oxford. We are a country the size of New Jersey with 7 million people in it. In the first 50 years of the state, our Nobel Prize winners were confined to two for peace, three actually, Shimon Peres and Rabin. Arafat also got that one. That will forever be a stain on the Nobel committee, Arafat's award. And Menachem Begin won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And the only other Israeli Nobel Prize winner in 1998, anyone? Before 1998. Shai Agnon in 1966 for literature. That was it. Every single year, almost every single year, Israeli scientists, Israeli mathematicians are winning the Nobel Prize. Almost every single year. It's something like five of the last 6 years we've had it. And you have this enormous reservoir of talent in the country. That is why, during the war, and the reason why, I should say, why the credit agencies did not downgrade debt is because they knew the fiscal policy and the monetary policy were steady and in good hands. So they know they're not going to go off the rails. They're not going in a different direction. We didn't downgrade the debt. But the reason why Hewlett Packard invested $4.5 billion in an Israeli company during the war was because of that human capital in the country. The reason why SanDisk invested during the war, did a swap of $1.5 billion on Israeli technology, flash disk technology, was because of that. That's the reason why Greylock Partners established a VC fund during the war. And it's why during the war, when I turned on my computer one morning at work, I saw a guy from Intel coming out of what seemed like a bunker. And they had a story that Haifa Intel, or Intel Israel, has just created the new chip that will be at the core of the production line for Intel in the years to come. That's why that happens there. That's why Motorola has the R&D, why Cisco has the R&D, why Intel has the R&D, why HP, why Google just announced today or yesterday that it's going to put R&D, because they want access to the brain power. Now, I just got my edition of the Forbes 400 a few weeks ago. I'm sure of them, you saw it. I was unfortunately not in it. Those of you who are wondering, the cutoff was a billion, and I was like 930 million, and I have issues. I've had issues. They apparently they underrepresented my salary at the embassy. But I may have asked this question last time, and if I asked this question last time, Scouts Honor, do not participate in it. But I may have asked it, I don't know, because it's something that always strikes me. 20 years ago, who was the richest person in the United States? 1985. What? No. He like came in 86, 87. Right before Walton, who was the richest person? No. Getty. In the early 80s, Getty was the richest person in America for quite a few years. The richest person in the world in the early 80s? Not the Queen. Close. The Sultan of Brunei. And the richest person in America and the world today is Bill Gates. And Getty and Sultan were in the same business, and Gates is in a different business. In the 21st century, the most important thing is not going to be horsepower. That was the 20th century. It was all about horsepower and how you can put horsepower to use. In a manufacturing world, you needed oil, you needed industry, you needed the horsepower to get ahead. The 21st century is all about brain power. That's what it's about. And there is no country in the world that is better able to harness the brain power of its people than Israel, because we have a brain power that is second to none, which is why I can tell you with full confidence that there will be all sorts of problems in Israel. All sorts of shocks that will happen to the system. This politician will say this. You may even see something happen in Gaza. You may see all sorts of events happen, just like the litany of events that I gave you before. And I'm telling you that in the end it won't matter. Because the engine that Israel has, that brain power, you can put 8,000 missiles on Israel. It's not going to affect the minds of our public at all. And it's the minds that are driving Israel's economy. And we have serious challenges. Serious security challenges that are going to require serious responses. But if you think that because of a bunch of terrorists firing missiles at Israel that our economy is going to collapse, then you're very much mistaken. The heart of our economy remains just as strong. The brain power that is fueling Israel's economic ship is getting stronger and stronger, not weaker. And I would encourage everybody who's both invested in Israel before and is thinking about doing it again, or a first-time investor to Israel, to get on board now, because we are going to roar ahead in the years to come. Thank you very much.
The agenda calls for a questions and answers session.
Maybe just questions.
Yeah, great.
Yes. Many you always hear about the going to the bank. I've got you two questions.
Yeah. Okay, as to the first question, the first question is about the issue really of overdrafts in Israel, how everybody seems to be in the minus in the bank account. It's a cultural thing in Israel where everybody is in minus in the bank account, and they're all sort of like 1 month or 2 months behind. But a lot of the problem, historically, frankly, and I hope there's no representatives of Bank Hapoalim and Bank Leumi, but Israelis got a raw deal. Israelis were paying way too much on their overdrafts, and they were getting way too little returns on their investments, on their savings, because it was a banking duopoly. That's what monopolies do. Monopolies steal money from the public. Duopolies steal money from the public. You know, it was very difficult. I mean, you may think that I'm a Netanyahu partisan, but let me tell you something. He was attacked viciously during the campaign, the last campaign, for being the one who went against the poor. The person that had the courage to go against the powerful interests in Israel was precisely him when he went after the banks. He said, I'm going to take away your duopoly. Now, you may not feel that because it doesn't come in your monthly check that you get from welfare, but let me tell you how you feel it. You feel it because you'll pay less interest rates on your debt to the bank. You'll earn more on your savings, and that 1 or 2% are very important because the people that are in the overdraft are not the rich. It's the poor. And one thing that they did to change that culture a little bit is they limited what banks could charge on overdrafts past a certain amount. There have been changes in the rules of what a bank would have to charge. And I think that they're addressing it. But long term, the most important thing in a financial system is, you know, you have people who put money into the system and people who need money in the system. That's how a financial market works. It can get more complicated with more players, but it's basically a very, very simple formula. You need more players in the financial system in Israel. The second you have more players, those people who only had access to a few players in Israel will have the opportunity to borrow money from a wide range of people. And then many of these ideas that are on a drawing board somewhere because they can't get access to capital will now come to fruition. It's very hard for an Israeli. You know, they can be, sometimes there'll be big investments with a VC fund which will find the right person, but the bootstrap approach in Israel, a small business being able to run into the bank and get, you know, $50,000 to take a shot at it is almost impossible in Israel because you have about 15 or 16 families that are controlling almost all the country's wealth. And in order to break that down, you have to demonopolize the businesses in Israel. And I think that we're well on the way to that. Look, as for the people in Gaza, I think that the issue of the economy is the least of my concerns for them. And these are people who were in a very difficult process. And regardless of what your position was on the disengagement, these people's internal world collapsed. And I think Israel has to do far more. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position directly in my position to do much about this. But I will tell you that I believe that much more has to be done to resettle them because it is not a simple economic issue. It was their whole world. Their whole world collapsed. What I didn't like very much, I was in Israel during the disengagement. And the next day, after the first day of sort of the images that you saw on television, the headline of Yediot Ahronot, a headline which I saved, I have the paper in my office, it says, Hakrav al Agag, which means the battle on the roof. And it was a battle of some settlers that were on a roof that were fighting with the police. I was astounded that that would be the headline of the paper the next day. I saw it as a total lack of historical perspective of what was happening. You know, if it would have been the nation mourns, it's difficult, you know, koev, alev, the heart, nothing. It was like it went through. And I think that attitude has changed a little bit in the wake of the war. Because of the war, the two areas where Israel has completely withdrawn has been bases sort of attack. That's changed a little bit. But I believe that those people, those 2,000 families, should be taken care of. In fact, my first piece of advice to the new Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, who I know fairly well, but I said to him that he should actually, as his first act of government, make a minister in charge of addressing all the outstanding concerns for that population. Because I think, even though I knew that he was ready to do another convergence, and that was he was elected on, by the way, and credit to him, he didn't hide it from the public. He was elected on that platform. He said, this is what I intend to do, and from a democratic point of view, it was the right thing to say. He spoke before and that he was going to do it. Even so, I do believe that it was the right thing to do to have a minister in charge of those people to help integrate them and to rebuild their lives. Unfortunately, like many things, it didn't happen. But those are, I can only say this, those are, frankly, some of the strongest people in Israel. And even Israel's government's not going to break them. Yeah.
I'm all aware of the recent purchase by Bob Levine. Investment of American companies in Israel, Cisco, the one that you mentioned, what are the other dynamics? Because buying and selling companies' investment is a two-way street. What is the relationship of Israel with concerns European economy, the Indian economy, the Chinese economy, the Japanese?
Right. Yeah, the question is, you mentioned about Buffett's investment in Israel, and you're wondering what kind of Israeli investments there are abroad, in China and India and Japan and other things. As for Buffett's investments, you know, I didn't mention it. It's a little small, insignificant investment of $4 billion in an Israeli company. What's interesting is that it was not a high-tech company. It was based in Israel. But why Buffett's investment, I should say, why that's so important, is there used to be this commercial when I was younger, you know, when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Probably one of the world's best commercials because I still remember it today. And you have to give the world a Coke. I think that may have been the other one. But when E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. Well, when Warren Buffett invests, people pay attention. And what I thought was so interesting about Buffett's investment, and Buffett didn't invest because he was a Zionist. He saw a real opportunity with a very strong company, and the whole story of how that came about is very interesting. He saw an Israeli partner that was very much like him, had built a company up from scratch, a very strong company that he could take to the next level. Buffett, by the way, during the war, or right after the war, said that it wouldn't have changed his mind whatsoever, the fact that there was a war in Israel, the investment. But what I was very hopeful for is that Buffett's investment would put Israel on the radar screens of people who would look at Israel no different than they would Sarajevo or, you know, Kosovo or whatever you are ever around the world. Bangladesh, it's just another country. But all of a sudden people say, hey, wait a second. Buffett's investing there, says he wants to invest more in the future. I'm going to pay attention to it. I think the war has stopped that Buffett effect. I think there's one effect of the war, I think short term, is that the Buffett effect got probably stymied. Because, you know, there are plenty, it's very hard to tell how things are going to affect investment because there are so many individual decision makers all over the place. But when people see Buffett, you know, all of a sudden they take notice, and they may have been straddling the fence for a long time, and that could have tipped them over. Maybe it would have taken another month, maybe another 6 months. They're looking at Israel. I think that's going to put them back on the fence. And in order to get them to invest again, Israel's going to have to show what it showed in the past, that we are capable of growing 5 or 6%. Non-inflationary growth for a serious amount of time in order to attract investment. As for Israelis investing abroad, you know, Israelis invest everywhere. Now, I don't know the actual numbers of India and Japan and everything else, but they are one of the best at finding their way. I should say this. What Israelis a lot of times, in my experience, have had difficulty in is getting in the door of these countries. It's the first deal that becomes very difficult for them to do. Once they're inside, they're the best at being able to navigate the system and to do more and more deals. The first deal is very hard. Israel's government has tried to help. In India, I know that we signed some sort of bilateral deal with India to do research and development. You know, the French, remember reading this, hearing this last year in Washington, very interesting. They give, we're not in a position to give foreign aid to countries. But the French, and by the way, one of the, I should say, one of the things that I'm proud of is I'm going to be the last Israeli, I hope, economic attaché to receive economic aid from the United States. We're due to receive $120 million this year, and next year, zero. And I think our economy is strong enough to not receive economic aid from the United States. I still receive military aid. I believe it's the best investment that Americans can make, both to their own military industries, but also to learning the tactics and methods and technologies that are going to be needed to fight enemies that are fighting everybody everywhere. And Israel's on the front line in that. So I think it's a very, very smart investment for America. But the French, I heard, they will invest in countries like India. And you know what they do? They give the aid, and then they condition the aid to they have to get products from French companies. And that's how they break down the doors. So major countries have a big advantage. They'll give money to the state in India, not necessarily to the country, but on a state level or a local level, they'll say you have to use French companies. So it's like a loss leader for them. They'll put, you know, $5, $10, $15, $20 million on the table, the French company eventually gets it. So, you know, the French are very good with subsidies. But that gives them a foothold that now they have the context, now they got the legal, the financial structures in place internally, and then they can do deals on their own. And I think that we can be creative about how we start doing this in different places. We have a lot of issues with investment abroad where we're not capable at this point of playing with the big players, and I think one of the challenges is to figure out creative ways to maximize our ability to do that. I don't think that we've done a very good job at that. I'm sorry.
I just want to take 60 seconds. I think I've known that 5 or 6 economic and
blow, blow away.
You are a great spokesman for the cause. I think you have a way about you and an explanation when you stand up. And I applaud you. And I heard that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Congressman Netanyahu, you have personal respect, personal friendship, and a lot of professional respect. In this I felt them when I was there as volunteer in August during the war, because the medical kits that we were preparing were going out every night because there was no store, there was no inventory, there was no warehousing. Number two, to your point about ISCAR and Warren Buffett's investment in $4 billion, I think one of the most important things to learn from this is not all about the $4 billion. What's important to know is how this affects the investment versus the tax bracket really trying to support ISCAR. Because the amount of taxes that $4 billion investment will be more in 1 year than all of the federations all around the world did to Israel in a given year. And that's one of the greatest arguments to me about why investment in Israel is something to supplant, not necessarily replace, but something to supplant the philanthropic giving that we do is so important. To look at Israel more as a business, more as an investment, not just as a philanthropy. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're welcome, and thanks for the compliment. And anyone else who'd like to repeat that, go right ahead. Feel free. Let me say this about, I don't want to sound the shill for Bibi, but I understand your concerns. But there is a problem in the assumption. The assumption that most people have in Israel is that if you cut a budget, you cut the services at the end of the line, and it's not true, because you can have a lot of waste in a system, and with the right priorities, you can see that even with cuts, you can deliver the same services much cheaper. I believe that Israel's government, on almost every single ministry, can deliver a higher level of service with less money. Believe it or not that I say that. Israel invests more in education than any country in the Western world, and our results, especially at the lowest level, we have the most educated workforce, but at the lowest level is not very great. Because, and I hope there's no one, the head of the teacher union is not here, but you have a level of bureaucracy there which is astounding. Absolutely astounding in Israel. The reason why you didn't have the medical kits is because when the defense ministry got their budget, they didn't want to make the tough choices. It had nothing to do with Netanyahu. Netanyahu says we're going to increase the defense budget. The issue is the defense minister has to go and has to have a courage to say, look, we're not going to have generals leave on a pension, or people from the army leaving a pension at the age of 40. We're not going to have army dentists. There's so much that can be done within the system without affecting it. And part of the problem in the war that a lot of people saw was that the basics were not provided. And very few people in Israel who know the facts internally believe it had anything to do with the defense budget. They say the priorities within setting the budget were very different. The finance minister doesn't get involved in all the details of the budgetary policy. I would like to see a greater incentive process for making cuts. Meaning, it's interesting how you can structure it. I thought about it for a long time. But if you can go to a minister and you can say, look, I'm going to give you a greater budget, but you're going to have to match it with cuts that you make. And so every dollar that you save internally, I'm going to give you an extra dollar. And then you have some regulatory mechanism that you can make sure that they're not, shelling the whole, hollowing out the whole system. But you can do incentive structures for ministers who are in charge of their own portfolios. Because, most ministers say, I'm in favor of budget cuts for him. Not for me. It's very rare that you have somebody willing to say, well, yeah, I'm going to accept that cut because I think that it's important. Now, your second point, just remind me, about investing in Israel.
On that point, for example, I can just tell you at 3:30 in the morning, Bibi Netanyahu
was on all of our lists. Okay. So there are many untruths being floated around, and I know he took a lot of the brunt of it, but really the blame doesn't go to him. And if anyone showed political courage to go against his base to do the right thing for the country, it was him. Now, I don't want to get into a whole, being a shill for Bibi, like I said, but I don't think it's right. And I think the people that know the budget understand that. It's very easy to say some guy made cuts. He's responsible for every bad thing that happens. It's just not good. A little responsibility, a little courage on the part of the ministers can make a world of difference. And I think you're going to see it in the years ahead. I particularly think you're going to see it in education coming up.
One question, Ron, was the tremendous shelling in the north. A lot of impact on the research areas and Haifa and Mount Carmel, IBM, all that stuff. Not that I know of.
I was in Israel. I went to Kiryat Shmona, and you see a lot of burnt out areas right on the side of the road. 1,000 rockets landed on Kiryat Shmona, a quarter of the rockets. There were no casualties in Kiryat Shmona.
The Katyusha weapon is a very, very unreliable weapon. Actually, the danger is the long rockets, the Fajr 3, Fajr 5, Iranian-made, some of them are Syrian-made. They can cause serious damage. And there was the Zalzal missile, which that Israel's army, I know gets a bad rap, but at the first day of the war, it's very interesting, by the way, about Israel's army. For many years, people thought Israel's got a terrific army, lousy economy. And now people think the reverse. Great economy, lousy army. It's not the case, and I can assure you that for everybody who's worried about the war, and any friend of Israel is always worried when they see the Jewish state at war, you should know that Israel used a fraction of its firepower in this war. We have plenty of reserves, and if Israel is to be criticized, it's for disproportionate use of force. It's for not using enough force to go, as other countries have and always have, to go and wipe out the enemy. But I have to tell you about this. Thank you. I have to tell you about, I'm actually much more optimistic about Israel than I was before the war. On a personal level, and I'll tell you why. Look, I'm 35 years old. I was not around in 1967. In 1973, I was in diapers. The Israel I knew was the Israel that started more or less with the Oslo process. That's when I came of age and continued. And Israel, Israelis deeply, deeply want peace. There was never a question in my mind of whether or not Israelis want peace. For the world, they always said Israel doesn't want peace. It's ridiculous. Whether you had a right-wing prime minister or a left-wing prime minister, it makes no difference. Whenever there was an Arab leader who came and talked peace, Israel made peace with him. If it were Begin and the Likud when Sadat came, if it was Rabin with Jordan, any time you had that. And to the fact that I was always critical before I was in a diplomatic capacity, that sometimes, you know, an Arab leader will say a half a nice sentence, you know, you got nice hummus in Tel Aviv and we're giving up half the country. That was my concern. What I did not know until this war was not whether Israel wants peace, but whether Israel is prepared to fight. That's what I didn't know until this war. I didn't know it. And I was worried that the peace overtures that Israel wanted to make because of the country's deep desire to make peace at almost any price could have been symptomatic of a deeper problem in the country. I don't believe that anymore, because I saw a situation where 90% of Israelis supported the war. 90% of Israelis. We have a guy, Aviv Geffen, in Israel, who's like a stone's throw away from Cindy Sheehan. He was supporting the war. Left, right, and center supported the war. And in fact, if the government has a problem in Israel, it's not because they led a country needlessly to war. It's because they didn't finish the job. The people were sitting in bunkers
supporting the war.
So people were supporting the war, absorbing the blows, and the concern, and they were ready to fight. And you can always change the policy of a government. And sometimes, often in Israel, you can change a government. But you cannot change a people. And Israel has a people with an enormous amount of resolve that are willing to look what my grandmother used to call Vildachayas. Vildachayas. Because that's what it is. And it's an economic speech, and I'm not going to skate out into the politics and everything. But understand that this is a conflict about a bunch of fanatics that want to bring the world to the 7th century against a country that is galloping into the 21st century. That's what the conflict is about. It's not a clash of civilizations, and I think the president was running this, it's a clash for civilizations. They love death, and we love life. But these were Israelis who stood there, stuck their heels into the ground, and said, we're willing to fight and to absorb that blow. And this is not like some cappuccino culture that you're just going to... He thought it was like a spider web. Nasrallah was, I'm sure, shocked, not only at the government's response to it, but also at the ability of the people to withstand it. Support in the war did not drop. 30 days. And Israel, by the way, is a country very different than any country in the world. And it took me a few years to learn this. Israel is the only country that I know of where military casualties are more painful than civilian casualties. At first, I found it to be very problematic, frankly, because I think when a soldier dies, as painful as it is not the same thing as putting your civilians in harm's way. It has a different psychological impact on the country. But the reason why that is so is very simple, because almost all Israelis serve in the army. And they have a cousin, or they have a nephew, or they have a son, or they have a brother, a daughter, who serve in the army. And you see that country that was willing to absorb these kinds of blows and was willing to stand their ground and to fight, to me, it was enormously, enormously valuable. Israel's people are strong enough to, I'm sure, meet any challenge. I have no doubt about it. And that gives me a lot of confidence for Israel's future.
Soldiers back soon?
Do you have a contact at Hezbollah?
Use it.
Look, this is something that is wrenching for Israelis. Another thing I said, something I learned in Israel, and it's related to that point about soldiers and civilians. You know, a few years ago, before I was in a diplomatic capacity, there was a deal that was made in Israel, if you remember, for three soldiers who had died and one civilian who was very problematic as to how he actually got there, and we gave up 400 prisoners, many terrorists, and everything else. And I was shocked. I said, it can't possibly be, but the people of Israel supported it. The people supported it, and you could think that it's right, or think it's wrong, but Israelis want to know that no matter what happens, they're going to come home. And they're willing to pay a very heavy price. And I can look back, you know, from outer space, when I had three children. The eldest is 3 years and 3 months. And I got a 21-month-old and a 4-month-old, and I'm, if I can be not as polite, I can say, we're knee-deep in blank, let's put it that way. Literally. But I don't have that soldier, and every Israeli parent wants to know that if anything happens, their kids are going home. I imagine that there will be constant pressure to do it. I think that the way you do it is not by Israel standing against them necessarily, by getting the world to stand very firm and to make it a demand. I mean, I would like to see a situation, for instance, and it's not a criticism of the current administration, but I'd like to see somebody tell, you know, Abu Mazen, you control a territory. I haven't seen any of your policemen die to free these soldiers. Don't come to the White House until those soldiers are free. You know? And I think that kind of message is going to be important. You say to Hamas, not only are you not going to come to the White House everywhere, and at any time, you said actually that you want to paint the White House black, which is one of these Hamas preachers said a long time ago, but it's not that you won't gain something, but you stand to lose a lot if you don't stand in line. And I think that's what we have. We have to take a very, very tough stance to them, and I just hope that they're safe and well and they'll come home soon. Maybe last. Maybe we'll take two and we'll see if we can spin them together. It's all the same answer in the end anyway, right? Go Israel.
You spoke about the economic benefits of the investments by Buffett and Google and Intel and Motorola and goes on and on. What are the geopolitical and security benefits to Israel of this money coming in, these companies having faith in Israel?
Your question?
The other side of the equation, what are the economic relationships of Israel to underdeveloped African countries?
Right. Let me answer the second one first. Israel actually, relative to its size, does quite a lot in the developed world in terms of sharing technology and know-how in Africa. You see it all the time, whether it's, you know, these Doctors Without Borders from Israel that go along, whether or not, you know, in this case, it's not the underdeveloped world, but if you remember during Katrina, Israel sent a search and rescue team. We've sent search and rescue teams in other areas. We do agricultural projects. Israel, relative to its size, does quite a lot. We're not in the aid game. We don't give money to IMF and international institutions the way that other countries do. But I think on an individual basis and a company-wide basis, a lot of Israelis are deeply connected to it and deeply committed to dealing with poverty, hunger, all these issues in Africa. And I think they do quite a lot. There's different organizations that you can look at to actually show it to you. As for what kind of event all those investments have, look, I will say that the more investments you have in Israel, the greater the ties between Israel and these multinational companies, the better we're going to be able to withstand all the attacks against you. You know, it's a way of rooting yourself. You know, one of the great challenges to me in Israel is that the country, and this is not a religious observation anyway, has got to be more connected to its past and its roots, because something without roots can get blown over right away. And that's a great challenge in the educational system, and there are certain Israeli politicians who have focused this. Most prominent is probably Moshe Yaalon. I don't know if you've heard him, the former chief of staff, who talks about these issues. I believe that it's going to require a secular leader, actually, not a religious leader, to bring those issues to the fore about Israel's connection to its place and its narrative and everything else, and to reconnect them. But on the economic front, to have these multinational companies come and invest in Israel is like putting in another stake and another stake and another stake and another stake. And it becomes very difficult then. When you attack Israel, you're also harming the investments of a lot of different players. You know, there have been times in history where countries have not been attacked or have been attacked because they had investments there or they didn't have investment there. I think it's very important, particularly when it's companies in the United States. I'll end with this observation. A few years ago, one of the greatest columnists, Charles Krauthammer, was in Israel. You may read him from the Washington Post occasionally. And he was talking about the challenges that Israel faces in the years ahead, and he, whatever the current government policy was at the time, he's usually against it, and he was against that policy as well. And he was asked the question, he says, does this mean that we're going to live by our sword for the rest of our lives? And he said, no. He said, well, the way that you're painting it, it seems like we're going to have to, that we're going to have like another Masada on our hands. It will be constant fighting, constant tension, which will lead to another Masada. He said, no, he says, this time there's a difference. This time Rome is on your side. We are in Rome, and I thank you all very much as Americans for your continued support of Israel to keep Rome also on our side, because at the end of the day, those who are our enemies are not trying to just deal with Israel. They're trying to take down Rome as well. And people understand it. Thank you for your support.
Just bear with us a couple of more minutes. First, we have a small Philadelphia gift to our speaker.
That's a big Philadelphia gift.
With pleasure.
Thank
you. I did listen to you last year, and it was as good and even better.
Thank you very much.
Just a couple of words from our sponsor, the Philadelphia Israel Chamber of Commerce, the America Israel Chamber of Commerce. In a minute, I'll ask Debbie, our executive director, to come up here for some closing remarks. I asked Debbie if she would speak about membership and why she joined as members, and she said if they listen to me, they think it's a sales pitch, they probably should listen from someone who is a member. So I'm not going to tell you why you should join as a member, other than saying you're here because you have an interest in Israel. Being a member of the chamber has been extremely rewarding. Everyone joins for different reasons. Think through why you're here, and I can tell you if you join the chamber, you will get many, many more benefits from it. There are application forms outside, and Debbie is here to answer questions. And thanks everybody for coming.
That is taller than me. The only thing better than hearing Ron speak about Israel's economy is seeing it for yourself. And if you don't believe me, it doesn't really matter, because I understand that Ron's going to be in Israel during the same time the chamber is planning its trip, so you can go to Israel with us and hear from him while you're there. The dates are February 17th to February 23rd. There are flyers on the desk outside. I'm available to answer any questions that you have. I heard Ron talk about the people as being the driving force behind Israel's economy, and I'd love for you to be able to see it for yourself. On November 22nd, the Chamber is hosting its next program. It's an informal discussion with an Israeli attorney who is visiting. The topic is international investment in Israel. Catch, there's this little theme going on here, but I hope you'll join us. There will be information to follow, and there'll be lots of great stuff in between. Thank you for coming, and I look forward to seeing you all in the future.